Chapter 9. The Last Winter. Fort Gaines had been a winter station, and winter on Mobile Bay was not winter as Wisconsin knew it. The air was not the same. The soil was not the same. A man could look across that water and feel the war narrowing itself toward one more place, one more line, one more order that would come when the officers were ready to give it. We had been moved and held and moved again so many times that a soldier learned not to believe any camp was truly fixed. Still, if a regiment stays long enough in one post, even a post of sand and wind and guard duty begins to feel like a thing one might have to leave. By March, we knew we were near the mouth of it. Mobile was the name that stood before us. The bay had been forced open the year before, but the city itself still lay beyond its defenses, and there were forts and lines and Confederate works enough between us and it. We had come a long road since Wisconsin. New Orleans, the Red River, Alexandria, the long falling back, Baton Rouge, Helena, Fort Gaines. A man could not carry all of it in his knapsack, though we tried to carry too much of everything else. On the 17th of March, the orders came. The waiting was over. Our brigade was to move. There is a kind of haste in military life that is not like farm haste. On a farm, a man hurries because weather is coming, or because stock must be fed, or because there is light enough left to finish a field. In the army, a man hurries because another man tells him the hour has come, and the whole body of men must rise with him. There is no private readiness. There is only the order. We went aboard the boats that night. The dark, the water, the low voices, the weight of the load on a man's back, the awkwardness of men stepping where they are told with muskets and blankets and haversacks. I had meant many times in the service to write home before a movement, and many times the chance went by. A soldier's wife lived with that silence. Janet lived with it more than once. I could think of Moundville and the house and the children, and still have no time to set down the words before the boat took us away. We landed at Navy Cove at 1 o'clock in the morning of the 18th, on the east side of the bay, not far from Fort Morgan. We had been there before, and that gave the place a strange familiarity. War makes a map of a man's memory. A name that once meant nothing becomes a shore where he slept, a road where he threw something away, a creek where a wagon sank, a field where a regiment waited for fire. At Navy Cove, the men got what rest they could on the sand until daylight. That is another thing a soldier learns. Comfort is not a bed. Comfort may be only the chance to lie down with the ground under you, and no order for an hour. After breakfast, we started along the Gulf shore. The day was fair, and the sea rolled beside us as if the war had no hold over it. We marched about 9 miles in sand. Sand is a hard road, because it is no road. It takes the strength out of a step and gives nothing back. Later that day, some of us went down to the shore. The water was not deep enough there to be dangerous, and men who had lived for months among mud, camps, smoke, and duty went into the briny water like boys for a little while. The waves came in over us. We came out chilled and red-skinned, laughing because laughter still had a place among soldiers when the hour allowed it. I do not remember that any man thought less of the campaign because we had that small pleasure. If anything, the pleasure made the campaign sharper. We were men still alive, and the next morning the drums would call us back to the work. On Sunday morning they beat early. The army rose before the full day came on. Breakfast had to be got, the line formed, the loads shouldered. The sand waited for us again. I thought of home that morning. I could not help it. There are mornings when a man's mind goes to what is opposite from what his body is doing. My feet were in the sand of Alabama. My back was under the weight of a soldier's load. My ears heard drums and orders and the talk of men moving out. Yet my mind saw the quiet of Janet's house and the children not marching anywhere, and the ordinary day beginning without bugle or drum. That is one of the mercies and one of the pains of a letter writer's life in the army, Home is always near enough to think of and always too far to touch. The country we passed through had houses enough to remind us that men and women had made lives there too. Fine houses stood in that sandy country, and around them the war had come like weather that would not pass by. We crossed water where the men had to wade deep, holding what they could above it. Clothes wet, loads wet, no proper time to dry, and still the column moved. A campaign is made of such things more than a civilian imagines. Not only battle, not only flags. A man remembers the weight, the wet, the rubbed shoulder, the sore foot, the missing sleep, the way a company looks after miles of bad going. Along the march, men began to lighten themselves. The winter things that had once seemed necessary became burdens a man could no longer justify. Blankets, extra clothing, garments carried against cold or need, all went out of knapsacks and onto the road. No soldier throws away comfort lightly. He does it when the march has taught him what the officers could not teach him by command. The body decides what can be carried. By afternoon, we came among the pines and stopped for the night. Pine country has its own sound and smell, different from the wet cane and low ground we had known elsewhere. The men gathered what they could for fires. Pine knots burn with a strength that seems stored in them from older heat. We made our place among the trees, what the record does not say. The night under the pines did not belong to the army alone. After the day's march, the men settled into the small noises of a camp trying to become quiet. Tin cups knocked softly. Leather creaked. Somewhere a horse shifted and blew through its nose. A man coughed. Another turned over and cursed the root beneath his blanket. The firelight did not reach far. Above it, the trees opened and the stars looked down as they had looked down on Wisconsin, as they had looked down on Janet's roof, as they had looked down on the roads by which we had come so far from home. I lay there and let my thoughts go where my body could not go. I saw Janet as a husband sees a wife when he is far away, not in one single picture, but in many small remembrances. Her hands, her voice, the way a household continues because a woman keeps it so. I saw the children, not as soldiers, name them in a list, but as lives entrusted to us. Eddie, Sarah Ann, Lizzie, James, and the little ones bound to me by the tender obligations of a father. I thought of father and mother, sisters and brothers, friends, all the circle that war stretches but does not break unless death is permitted to break it. There, under the trees, I did not feel myself beyond the hearing of God. The woods were not a church, but prayer does not require boards or a pulpit. A man who has marched all day and may march into battle soon learns whether his hope is only talk. I had health. I had breath. I had a place on the earth for that night. If the Lord allowed me to see home again, I would bless him for it. If he did not, then I asked that the parting here would not be the last meeting of those who belong to Christ. The fire went lower. Men slept. The stars remained. The days after that drew us northward into worse country. Rain came hard, and the roads, if they could be called roads, failed beneath wagons and batteries. The army could not move its weight through swamp without making a way for itself. So, the men went to timber. We had seen timber work before. Wisconsin men understood axes, trees, and the handling of wood, though an Alabama swamp was not a Wisconsin woodlot. Corduroy road is a hard mercy. It means mud has defeated the ground, and men must lay a road over it piece by piece. Pine was plentiful, and that was well, because there was a long stretch where wheels and teams could not pass without help. The work was heavy. The teams went down. Men strained to get them out. Rain, mud, shouted orders, the sucking sound around wheels and hooves, all of it made the march into labor before it could become battle. By the 24th, we reached Fish River and crossed. Troops were gathering there. The 16th Corps was present, and our own 13th Corps stood under General Granger. the army was no longer merely moving through country. It was drawing itself together before the Confederate works. Blakely lay to the north, Mobile beyond, and Spanish Fort stood in the way of the city. We did not yet know all that would come. A soldier hears reports. He hears distances, names, guesses, boasts, and warnings. He hears that the enemy is near, or that he has fallen back. He hears that there will be a charge, or a siege, or another march. He does not know until the hour comes which word was true. What I knew was simpler. I had health enough to stand it. The march had been hard. The load had been too much. Men with families had a different weight from the unmarried men, though the army counted us by company and regiment all the same. A married man carries his wife and children in the part of him no quartermaster sees. When he lies down under trees, he may dream himself home and wake to find only the woods above him. From Fish River we moved into the work before Mobile. The army gathered itself at Fish River and then turned north and west toward the Confederate lines that guarded the bay. We were one regiment among many. The 16th Corps had come down from Tennessee and now stood near us. The 13th Corps under Granger held its place. United States colored troops served alongside white regiments in the column. Wisconsin men marched beside Iowa men, Illinois men, Maine men, Indiana men. The army was big enough that a soldier in one regiment could pass days without seeing the regiment that camped a mile from his own. The country around Spanish Fort was wet, low, and broken with creeks. Spanish Fort itself was a Confederate work that guarded the eastern approach to Mobile, set on a bluff above Bayou Minette and the open water beyond. We did not see the fort itself at first. We saw the lines that protected it, and we saw the ground we would have to take to come within rifle shot of it. The order was for a siege. The army would not throw itself against the works in a charge. It would dig. A siege is one of the slow ways a war is fought. It is also one of the hardest. Men who imagine soldiering as battle do not always picture it as shovels in the dark, and earth thrown up before the next bullet finds the place where a head had been a moment before. Yet that was the work. We dug a line of approach. We threw up parapets. We made room behind them for guns. We dug saps that crept forward toward the enemy. We learned the routine of a siege as we had once learned the routine of a march. The Confederates in the fort fired at us when they could see anything to fire at. We answered with our own muskets and with the artillery the army brought up. There was rarely a quiet hour. Through the day the bullets went over the parapets and into the trees behind, and through the night the picks and shovels worked the earth forward. A man learns to sleep with such sounds the way another man learns to sleep with weather. There is no other way to keep going. The dead and the wounded began to be carried back. They came in twos and threes and sometimes more after a sharp morning. The aid stations did what they could. The surgeons worked under the same fire that worked the rest of us. A man took his chance and watched his comrade for changes in the face that meant the bullet had gone where it was not safe for it to go. Spanish Fort cost the army a steady toll across 2 weeks. Not the toll of a great battle in a single day, the toll of a fortnight in which the line was never quiet. I will not pretend I knew the larger plan. A regiment in a siege learns its sector and trusts the officers above it to know the rest. We knew our work. We knew our place in the trench. We knew the men beside us. When orders came to move forward a few yards, we moved. When orders came to hold, we held. The siege grew by inches, measured in earth and in lives that were not ours, but were near enough to be felt as if they had been. Letters from home stopped reaching me for a stretch in those days. Mail had a hard time finding a regiment in a siege. I told myself Janet was writing, that her letters were on a boat somewhere, that the post would find me when the army was again in a place where the post could find anyone. Still, the silence had its own weight. A soldier in the trenches learns that the worst hour is not always the hour of fire. Sometimes it is the hour when the firing has stopped, and there is nothing to do but think about a house 1,000 miles away, and a wife who does not know whether the silence is silence or worse.
From the other side of the letter, in Wisconsin, the news from the Army came in pieces. The papers reported a movement toward Mobile, but could not say where the regiment had gone within it. Janet read what she could. She asked what neighbors had heard from sons or husbands or brothers in the same army. She walked to the post office at Moundville and waited for what might be there. The work of the house did not stop because the work of the army had begun again. The children had to be fed. The hay had to be watched. The cow had to be milked. A letter from a husband at the front did not arrive any faster because a wife waited for it more. What the documentary record does not preserve is the sound of those days inside the house at Moundville. A child asking, a neighbor calling, a floorboard, a wind, the sound of a woman waiting and not telling the children how hard the waiting was. That is the part of the war the newspapers did not print and the army did not count.
The work at Spanish Fort went on through the end of March and into the first week of April. The army's earthworks crept closer. The artillery grew heavier. The Confederate fire weakened in places and held in others. A siege is read by the men who live it as a kind of weather, a thing one observes and adjusts to. On the night of the 8th of April, after 12 days of trench work, the Confederate garrison gave up Spanish Fort. They abandoned the works under cover of darkness and made their way across the bay or into the country beyond. The morning of the 9th showed us the fort as we had not yet seen it, the earth torn by our guns, the works empty of their defenders. I do not write of the soldiers' satisfaction at that morning because the army did not give us time for it. The fall of Spanish Fort was one part of the work, and another fort still held. Fort Blakely lay to the north on the same eastern shore, and Blakely had not given up. The army turned at once toward Blakely. The 16th Corps held the Union right. The 13th Corps was placed on the left. United States colored troops were in the line. The orders came that an assault would be made on the afternoon of the 9th of April. The whole front would move at once. The fort would be carried or the army would fail before it. There is no preparing for a charge that another man can make for you. A soldier hears the order and feels the change in his body before his mind has had time to think about it. The chest tightens. The hand finds the musket without being told to find it. The breath shortens. The mouth dries. A man may pray, and many do. A man may make peace with thoughts of home, and many do that too. I had been a man of prayer all my life, and I did not stop praying when the order came. We went forward at the time we had been told. The country between our works and the Confederate line was open and broken. There were obstacles and rifle pits and the steady fire from the fort itself. Men fell on either side of me. I cannot say I saw who fell and who did not. A man in a charge sees in pieces. He sees the ground in front of him. He sees the next obstacle. He sees the man immediately to his side. The rest is felt before it is understood. The line did not break. The fort was carried. We went over the works and into the ground where the Confederate defenders had been, and the resistance gave way. Hundreds of prisoners were taken. The Confederate flag came down. The army held Fort Blakely by the evening of the 9th of April, 1865. I cannot give the count of our dead and wounded with the certainty of a quartermaster. I knew that the regiment had paid. I knew that the brigade had paid. I knew that the Corps had paid. United States colored troops had stood in the line and had borne their share and had paid as well. The men who had marched the sand from Navy Cove and waded the swamp and dug the trench at Spanish Fort had been brought through to this last work, and not all of them had been brought through it whole. I was alive. The simple fact of that came over me as I stood inside the captured works and looked back over the ground we had crossed. A man is not philosophical at such a moment. He is grateful in a plain and bodily way. He is also tired beyond ordinary tiredness. The body that has carried itself through a charge does not at once let itself feel anything but the work it has just done. The army did not rest. There was Mobile to be entered. The Confederate forces in the city had been watching the eastern shore and now had no defense to fall back upon. On the 10th of April, the rumor was that the city would be evacuated. On the 11th, the rumor became fact. On the 12th, the army entered Mobile. I would not have predicted in February of 1864 that the country in which my service would end would be the Gulf Coast of Alabama. A Wisconsin man does not picture himself in such a place. Yet there I was on the 12th of April, in a column of Union infantry going into a city that had been one of the last great Confederate ports of the Gulf. The streets did not cheer us. The streets did not jeer us either. The streets stood quiet as cities under occupation stand quiet, watching what the army would do. The buildings of Mobile were taller than the buildings of any town I had seen in the army service. There were warehouses along the riverfront. There were churches. There were houses set back from the streets with iron at the windows. There were black men and women who watched the column from the side streets. And there was a particular look in their faces I will not forget. A soldier in the Federal Army learned to recognize that look. It was the look of people who had heard for a long time of an army that might come, and now the army had come. The regiment was placed at a guard post in the city. The work of occupation began. There were buildings to secure. There were prisoners to manage. There were orders to be carried and counter-orders to be obeyed. The army would settle into Mobile as it had settled into so many other places, with the difference that this place had been a Confederate city until that morning and was now under our hand.
Looking back from the diary Edward bound at 70, I did not know on the morning of the 12th of April what news was already moving toward us through other roads. Lee had surrendered at Appomattox on the 9th, the same day we took Fort Blakely. We did not know it then. Lincoln had three more days of life. We did not know that either. There is a kind of mercy in not knowing the hour. The men who went into Blakely on the 9th did not know they were attacking a fortress on the day Lee was laying down his sword. The men who entered Mobile on the 12th did not know they were entering a city in the last week of the president's life. We were still soldiers in a war we believed continued. If I had known what was coming, I do not think I would have been a better soldier for the knowing. A man does the work that is given him. He trusts that the larger work is being done by larger hands than his own. When the news came to us, as it did within the next several days, the campaign was over and a quieter time began. But on the 12th of April, we were still in the war. I have lived long enough to see Mobile become a city of peace again, and the country that was Confederate become a country shared. I do not know what was meant by the Almighty in giving the regiment its last hard work on the day Lee was already laying down his arms. I only know that we did the work because it was the work in front of us. That is all a soldier knows, and it is enough.
That night, I lay down in a house in Mobile, on a floor with my coat for a pillow, and I thought of Janet and the children. I had thought of them at Pine Woods looking up at the stars, and I thought of them again in a house that had, until a few days before, belonged to people who would have called me an enemy. The thought of home was the same in both places. It was the thought of a man who had been gone too long and did not yet know how soon he would be sent back. The war went on, as we believed. The orders for the next day would come. The army would settle into the routine of an occupation that would not yet feel like an end. We did not know what we did not know. We slept where we could. We rose when we were told. The last winter had ended in a city that until that week we had been ordered to take. I closed my eyes in Mobile on the night of the 12th of April, 1865. I did not know that a man in Washington had 3 days left to live. I did not know that a general in Virginia had laid down his sword 3 days before. I knew only that I was alive, that I was not at home, and that I would write to Janet in the morning if the army gave me time enough to write.